This is Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, how many times should you actually flip your burgers on the grill? We talked to a math professor who crafted a model to find the optimal cooking method. Now, nationwide test scores in math from 9-year-old students declined for the first time in the history of the National Assessment of Educational Progress tests. They started in the 1970s. Test scores in reading among that same age group also saw their largest decline in 30 years, and that's based on data released by the National Center for Education Statistics from 2020 to 2022. The assessments highlight the learning lost during the pandemic and the need for extra support to help children catch up. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What are you wondering? What was your experience as a parent or a teacher? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Our guest is Richard Halverson, a professor of educational leadership and policy analysis at the UW-Madison School of Education. Rich, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
We have this information on standardized test scores. They are one sliver of the puzzle. How do we begin to assess how much learning we lost from the beginning of the pandemic until now?
I think that's it's a really good question to ask. And, you know, the role of schools in our society has always been pretty contentious. People argue a lot about schools and the value of schooling. But one thing this shows is how valuable our existing school system is for learning, that when you take away significant parts of our traditional schooling system, our kids really fall behind on the measures that we count as making progress. One of the things that is the most disturbing about this discussion is how the losses are disproportionately falling on the kids who rely on school the most. And that really shows how we need to have a renewed investment in our schools to make sure that all kids have a chance at having successful learning experiences.
Say more about that disproportionate effect.
I think if you look at the New York Times just had an article about this, and they said that the people in the lowest category of test performance lost the most from being out of school. And I think this is for a couple of different reasons. First of all, kids who score higher on tests tend to go to schools with more resources. And so their teachers typically had experience with sort of digital platforms and other forms of communicating instruction. And the kids who were in schools where the kids are struggling tend to have not made those investments in technologies for learning and personalized learning because they're so focused on trying to help kids master basic skills in the schools.
So we're seeing the pandemic compounding these disadvantages that some students were already experiencing.
Yeah, I think it's really important for us to recognize that signal, that this was sort of another indicator of how important schooling is for moving towards equitable learning in our society. But it also talks about, now, what are we going to do about it? There's all this research that's been done around the difference between remediation and engagement. And remediation is when you try to catch students up to a level where they're supposed to be. And engagement is when you try to meet students where they're at and move forward. And I guess what I'm worried about is that the rhetoric of learning loss is going to lead us down a path of remediation that we know does not engage young learners in their work. Like the catch-up metaphor might work at the policy level, but it's really hard for second and first graders to picture their learning as catching up.
But that is how we talk about it. We talk about students able to read at grade level or being two levels ahead or being behind. That's common in how we discuss it.
I think it is common in the policy world and in the public world. I think there's many teachers and many folks who are researchers in this space who talk about meeting students where they are and trying to develop skills from the interests that they bring to schools. And we know this for a long time in education research. The best way to get students to do well on tests is to prepare them to do well on tests. In other words, to have curricula that teach the kind of skills that lead to success on standardized tests. And in many cases, those skills are not particularly transferable, like learning to read apart from your interest in reading and learning to calculate apart from cultivating an interest in math has value within schools, but has less value in the world.
Well, I mean, that naturally brings up the question then. I mean, we see these test scores are down for the first time in a very long time. Are nationwide test scores an effective way to measure student learning and perhaps what we've lost in the pandemic?
I think that the test score system that we've developed is a good indicator for how successful our schools are at teaching young people what we want them to know. Mm. And schools are still the best path for social equity. They're the best path for opportunity. And so in that context, test scores are a very important indicator. There are other indicators. There are other ways to see, to measure the degree to which students are engaged in their learning and can make progress towards fulfilling lives and careers that the pandemic sort of opened up this possibility. I'll give you an example. A lot of young people during the pandemic found their at-home schooling not that engaging. And there's been a tremendous explosion in like YouTube creativity, young people making videos about their interests, participating in online cultures, doing like video gaming cultures, that has led to a real explosion in the kind of skills that young people are learning that are relevant in their careers. But our schools really focus on the kinds of skills that are measured by standardized testing, which, again, is valuable, but doesn't tell the whole picture.
We're talking with Rich Halverson, who's a professor of educational leadership and policy analysis in the UW-Madison School of Education. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What have you seen in children throughout the pandemic? Perhaps you're a teacher or you're a parent. What's happening with the kids in your lives? What kind of help do you see them needing, or what solutions do you see? You can give us a call now at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@wpr.org. When we are talking about this, Rich, we are looking at the national assessments and that, in particular, this 9-year-old age, right around the third grade level. Why is that an important benchmark when we're thinking about student learning and the information that we're giving them, the way we're teaching them?
The third grade reading tests have been important for a really long time because they make the transition, they mark the transition from young people moving from the mechanics of reading, sort of the phonics, grammar mastery, to interest-based, content-based literacy. And for years, our schools have been formed around the idea that you got to have the basics down before you move to interest-based learning. And so the third grade reading tests, which really get at the structural parts of literacy, have been elevated as really important indicators of how successful our schools are being. Now, you know, a lot of young people come to school with the rudiments of reading already developed. Some young people come to school with, and that's what they have, is what school gives them. That's why the third grade measure has been so important over the years.
Schools can provide resources and opportunities. That's one part of the equation. So is a responsibility that falls on a parent to help students, you know, stay on top of things. I know you've said you don't like the idea of catching up, but to really try to meet whatever bar is set for their grade and their curricula, what is that split and how do we figure it out? What's the school's responsibility versus what we should be expecting of parents?
This is a really interesting question, Keely, because there have been a number of folks in the research world who have been interested in studying what do wealthy and upper class families do to support education for their children. And there is support, reading at home, that sort of thing. But there's also a tremendous investment in engagement activities, arts activities, athletics activities, new literacy activities like computer coding, these sorts of things, and after-school programs and summer camps, all of which create a sort of a powerful learning atmosphere for young people where literacy becomes an important part of how they engage in these kinds of programs. So it is true that families that invest in these kinds of opportunities for their children give their children a leg up. They have a wider range of experiences that make their learning relevant. On the other side of the spectrum, poor families don't have the resources to invest in those kinds of activities that make literacy and math learning relevant to young people. They just got schools. And so it really makes it important for us to think about schools as the pathway, not only for skill mastery for young people, but also to cultivate their interest in learning.
We're talking to UW Madison Educational Policy Professor Rich Halverson, talking about a decline in nationwide elementary school test scores since the start of the pandemic and what we can do to help kids learn. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What have you seen the pandemic do with children's education? What have you seen change in teachers? Maybe you are one. What are the things you have to think about now that you didn't a few years ago? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Looking forward to hearing from you as our conversation continues here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina. Our guest is Rich Halverson. He's a professor of educational leadership and policy analysis in the UW-Madison School of Education. And he's with us today to look at how pandemic learning loss hurt nationwide elementary school test scores and the ways that we can think about that, the ways also that we can help students catch up. Taking your calls at 800-642-1234 or emails at ideas@wpr.org. Rich, what advice would you give to parents who are trying to figure out how to support their students right now in this really, unique moment in education?
I think thank you for that question, Keely. I think that the one thing is to listen to students, listen to young people and their learning about their learning experiences. We've been waiting for years in the country for a digital revolution in schooling, where schools would start to take advantage of the same kinds of technologies that are used all over the rest of the world for learning. And during COVID, it largely happened. I have my daughter is in Madison Public Schools, a proud student at West High School. And prior to the pandemic, there was relatively little use of things like Google Classroom and other virtual tools to coordinate learning. And now all of her classes are on Google Classroom. And so this allows our learners to be so much more autonomous than they were before in creating their own learning spaces. So having parents listen and watch how their children are engaging in learning is really important, to learn alongside of them. The other thing is that there's so much more information that we have about the progress that young people are making. Schools use very sophisticated testing instruments to show how much progress a student has made, and typically those data are available in some way from the teacher or from the school. So understanding where their children are on the pathway to progress and help talking with them about what they can do to move them forward is also a good suggestion. My final suggestion is that I mentioned YouTube before. I mean, YouTube is just an amazing variety of learning resources that many young people found during the pandemic. I mean, you could find a lecture on anything. You could find an interactive learning activity on any concept in math or literacy. And so parents who are interested in doing some work along with their children to help advance learning can find lots and lots of really high-quality resources online.
As much as we see schools trying to operate in a post-COVID world, coronavirus still spreads everywhere, schools, classrooms. Do you think schools are prepared enough now to handle these disruptions?
I think they're more prepared now than they were, in 2020. Mainly because of this forced reliance on technological tools. One of the articles that's referenced in the Times article led me to think about these new technologies that are available that provide instruction to young people based on their level of performance. They're called computer adaptive learning systems, and in many schools have been skeptical of computer adaptive learning tools because they look like they replace teachers. And of course they don't, because nothing replaces a good teacher. But I think what's happened during COVID is that people have seen the value of these kinds of tools as supplementary. And teachers are increasingly seeing these things. They're not as good as what I can do as a teacher, but they can sure help me guide my students at the levels where they need support. So I think that the awareness and the use of technologies for learning is really gives teachers a step up. So if, you know, God forbid we had another outbreak crisis, teachers would be much better prepared to support student learning.
Talking with Rich Halverson, a professor of educational leadership and policy analysis in the UW-Madison School of Education. Just a few more minutes for your call at 800-642-1234. Rich, I want to stick with this idea of technology, though, because just in the news this week, we have schools out of New York City saying, we don't need snow days because we have this technology now. I'm a little bit torn in personally experiencing this, trying to think about it. You know, if I have access to use my school-issued device at home with internet access, I can understand how that might help continue learning so that there aren't disruptions. And I can also see the flip side where students who don't have that accessibility could be further left behind. What do you see in this?
I think one of the main policy pushes that I've seen in the last year and a half is to create universal access to learning technologies. Like the Madison School District has undergone a tremendous push in the last 2 years to make sure that every student has a viable device to support their learning. The idea of the digital divide has been really accelerated, and closing the digital divide by recent policy initiatives and funding initiatives. So we're not there yet, but it's getting closer so that learning can be accessible by most learners. But on the other hand, I grew up as a Wisconsin boy, and man, snow days are the gift. You get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and then you hear a call that there's no school and you get to go back to sleep, or I'll shovel the walk. I mean, that's a gift I hope we don't have to give up.
Yeah, there's an emotional component there as we think about the education component. When you assess the information about students and teachers realizing that students are, you know, behind where we'd like them to be, and we're talking about things like these national standardized test scores dropping, what kind of ripple effects can you see the last 2 years having on education?
I think, you know, the global pandemic as a result of COVID is an unprecedented event in most of our lives. You know, most of us have never seen a global crisis that shuts down basic institutions like this. And we are just now starting to get indicators of the effects of this extraordinary human event on our lives. I think my concern is that these early signals not be taken for the main signal. So if there's test score dropping, does that mean we're not going to pay attention to the skill development that happened as teachers and learners started to take control of their own learning environments? Are we going to move towards a remediation framework in our schooling system as a whole to catch up? Or are we going to really focus on the idea that we can reinvent schools now based on where students are as well as where we need them to be? And so my main concern is taking these early signals as the only signals and not listening to the full range of evidence that we're going to get from COVID as we move forward.
Do you think that's possible on the policy side, given all of the politics of education?
I think there's a loud voice in the policy world in education that considers test scores the measure of education progress. But it's a voice. It's not the only voice. There's many, many people who are in the education space who speak for the value of the arts or the value of expression or the value of attainment or just showing up, the value of persistence, the value of what young people bring to their education, what's the assets that families bring to education. So I feel like that is a voice, and it's a loud voice, but it's not the only voice. And, you know, as a public institution, schools are obligated to listen to the public's voice. And I think this will be an ongoing conversation as we try to figure out how to change schools as a result of COVID.
Yeah, certainly an ongoing conversation for sure. Rich Halverson, really appreciate your time as we walk through everything today when it comes to the latest information that we have about those test scores and what you see happening in education. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Keely.
Rich Halverson is a professor of educational leadership and policy analysis in the UW-Madison School of Education. He was with us today to share the ways that we might be able to think about the idea of kids catching up on pandemic learning loss, how we can consider it as a nation, and really how much weight we should put into the fact that we saw nationwide test scores showing a decline in elementary school math and reading levels, which are crucial for our understanding of how we are educating our children. When you throw burgers on the grill, you'll inevitably grapple with the conundrum that all grill masters face. Your patties are sizzling, maybe starting to drip a little. Are they ready to be flipped? You want to get them a nice char from the grates of the grill, but you don't want to dry out the meat. And then once you do flip them, you're left wondering again, was that enough time? Will they be done? Should I flip them another time and another time? Our guest today knows your struggle and decided to use his expertise in math, physics, and thermodynamics to look for a definitive answer. Jean-Luc Thibault is a professor of applied mathematics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He crafted a mathematical model for how often to flip a burger or any other food on a grill to cook it most efficiently. Jean-Luc, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Let's just get this out of the way. How many times is the optimal number of times to flip a burger?
Well, I've been saying four, though in my paper, I don't actually give an optimal time because the answer would be as many times as you can, but you'd need to go faster and faster each time. So you have to kind of hit a sweet.
And how long do you wait between those flips? Sounds like we might need to reconnect with Jean-Luc, so you can give us a call at 800-642-1234 as we talk with a mathematics professor about how there is an art and maybe some math to grilling. You are welcome to give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email us your ideas at ideas@wpr.org. Talking about that opportunity, when you flip, how long you figure out when it's done. I know that there are other items people use on the grill too. And sometimes people are very much, I don't flip things. They stay as long as possible. They cook all the way through and I flip at the end. Or maybe you're one of those people that knows that you should flip them less, but you're just consistently, constantly at the grill with the spatula or, you know, clinging those tongs together and flipping. How do you handle grilling and how do you figure out how often to flip meat or veggies or whatever else you're putting on the grill? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. It's one of the many different things that we talk about here on Central Time. Up ahead, we're talking about Wall Street analysis that some nonprofit hospitals get major tax breaks for the charity care that they offer. But when we actually look at the data, they aren't giving as much charity care as you would think. So that's still ahead on Central Time, along with A Wisconsin Life about making tortillas. So stay tuned for that. I think we have Jean-Luc Thibault back with us. Professor, are you here?
Yes, I'm sorry I'm here. I'm not sure what happened.
No worries. Technology is a gift and a curse. So you were talking about the fact that optimally you would have to flip burgers quickly, and you would have to change the intervals. Help us understand, you're a math professor, not a food scientist. How did you make this model?
So I was reading an article in the food blog by Kenji Lopez Alt, who's a well-known food writer, and he was mentioning that, you know, there's a lot of controversy about the number of times to flip a burger. Well, you know, some purists say once and you're done, and other people say that you should kind of flip as often as possible because, in a way, the more you flip, the more you're exposing to the hot side, so the faster it'll cook. So I wanted to see whether, you know, what was, if you tune between these two extremes, what would you get as cooking times? And the conclusion is that you do cook faster if you flip more, as you might expect. But there's very much a diminishing return. So after doing it about four times, in other words, you're not really gaining much on the total cooking time.
Without getting too far into the weeds, how do you approach a math problem like this conceptually?
Well, I love to do what's called modeling in physics and applied mathematics. So we write equations that describe the kind of building blocks of the system that we're trying to model. So we think carefully about, you know, in this case, heat is clearly the important thing, right? But we also need to think about what it does mean to cook and how do you build that into a mathematical model. So the art of mathematical modeling is to first break up the problem into little bits and reformulate it mathematically, and then just kind of see what tools you have available to analyze this problem. And sometimes you need to invent new tools, which is the fun part of being a mathematician.
So you put together this mathematical problem. The model is theoretical. Have you tried it out in the real world to see how it functions in practice?
I try to be a little bit realistic about this model in the sense that I set out to do this because it was sort of, to me, an intriguing first step. But there's so many things that I didn't put in this model, like the fat content of the meat, which will, you know, would vary depending on what you grill, right? So the model really should, at its base, applies to burgers, but also to chicken or to eggplant. And once you start going into the details, that can shift the cooking time by a lot, as everybody knows, of course. And so, you know, to say that I've tried the model, it predicts some broad things. Like, for instance, it predicts an interesting thing, that the last flip is the most important, that the last cooking period should be twice as long as the previous cooking period. So that's something interesting, and I'm going to try to experiment a little bit with that. But I would say that the model doesn't – I would not say the model makes precise enough predictions at this point to be able to rely upon it to actually do grilling. It's really what we call a qualitative model more than anything at this point. But it could be made more complex.
We had John from Freedom say, you cook meat as little as possible and then you let it sit. Don't play with it, just let it cook. What do you think about that when you also have this model that encourages you to flip the burger to cook it most efficiently?
Yeah, I think it depends on what meat you're grilling. Because flipping a burger, one thing you're doing is you're dumping all the fat whenever you flip. So, and some people consider that to be a very bad thing, right? But if you're cooking something more like chicken or like eggplant, you know, if you're grilling eggplant on the barbecue, then you're clearly not dumping any fat. So I would say that the model is probably a little bit more applicable to eggplant than it is to burgers or to grilling, you know, zucchini on the barbecue or something like that. In that case, I think moisture is much less of a concern than it is with meat.
So some of the variables we've already pointed out are the fat content, the moisture content. What are other important variables involved in calculating this?
Well, one important one is texture, right? One thing I didn't put in at all is that people like to have grill marks. People like to have a crust on a piece of meat, right? So that part, I'm not even really sure how to simulate that, right? I mean, there's a limit to what mathematical models can tell us. The human palate likes various things about food, and there's only so much I can do mathematically to model things. So no grill marks in my model.
So that's one of the things I guess you can't measure or really account for in a mathematical model for flipping burgers.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, if you can't account for all of it, why do you find it still meaningful to think through a model for something like this, even if it doesn't apply to everything practically?
So sometimes you learn things about the physical process itself. And in fact, what this modeling problem has its origins in other work that I do involving, say if you want to cool a microprocessor, you use a fluid, and the fluid is kind of taking heat away from the microprocessor and liquid cooling. And the overturning of the fluid has a lot to do with the same way that the burger is getting flipped on the grill. you're really trying to take heat away from the system. For the burger, you're trying to put it in, but taking it away is the same thing as putting it in mathematically, except with a minus sign. So the real motivation behind all this is just to understand more and more about thermal transfer and about how we get heat in and out of things, which is an important problem in so many areas of the world. As we live in Wisconsin, so we know very well that it's either too hot or too cold, right? So we need to do something.
Well, as long as we can hook people's attention with a burger, I think we can talk about it more. Jean-Luc, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Keely.
Jean-Luc Tufo is a professor of applied mathematics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the simple joys of making tortillas.
Many of us have strong memories tied to making food with our families. Writer Araceli Esparza shares a poem about the bonds that are nurtured while making fresh, fluffy tortillas from scratch.
She gets the flour. She gets the flour and the salt. She gets the flour, the salt, and the water. Hungry for my cloud tortillas. Waiting feels like a year. The water, the flour, and the salt in a bowl, she begins. Hungry hunger rumbles in my tummy. She folds in the parts of my cloud and tells the dough how much I will love what it will become. Pitter-patter, thump-thump, everyone comes down the stairs. And now we all squeeze in to watch Josita, Tommy, Lupita, and even little Juanito. On the table, she rolls a little ball of masa. Will I get my own? Then she centers the masa ball on the tortilla press, pulls down the lid, and presses hard. Pat, pat with her manos. 5 kids watching, waiting. Will I get my own? Smack on the comal on the stove. Dale vuelta, tia. Give it a turn, tia. We whisper, shout. Little Juanito begins to whine. My cloud tortilla dream begins to evaporate. Couple of turns and browning, bubbles form. Will they burn? My cloud tortilla was done all fluffy, light, and warm. Tia asks, who wants the first tortilla? Everyone answers, me, 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 me. But I say, yo, por favor. Tia gives me the puffy treat I've been waiting for, and I float to the ceiling. I spread a butter moon on top of my tortilla, but I see little Juanito, and I roll it up and give it to him. And I show him how the cloud eating is done.
That's Madison writer Araceli Esparza sharing a poem about making tortillas. I asked her why she wanted to write about food and her family.
I remember as a small child, going up to New Berlin with my great aunt and my grandmother and my mother and all of us driving up there to visit her. They've known each other for so long, and just her cooking and the flour tortillas. Oh my gosh, I never seen somebody make them by hand. So when you go in Mexico, you typically see corn tortillas made in a machine, a tortilla, right? And so, but to see the process done by hand, and then it was so methodical and just so yummy. Oh my gosh, just like a slice of heaven.
So what have tortillas meant to you in your life?
You know, when I think about all the debates that's happening right now and what can bring us together, people often say breaking bread. Let's break some tortillas together, right? We can have country tortillas. We love our street tacos. Let's talk about that more and let's talk to each other while we're breaking tortillas, maybe. I have tons of little tortilla stories about one time I when you have an electric stove, okay, so I get kind of picky of how to get them. A gas stove tortillas are just so much better than an electric stove, right? But sometimes, okay, with the electric stove, you have to really watch when you make them, and they can come up actually rubbery and hard. And so there's this anecdotal moment that I remember clearly with my grandmother, and I had an electric stove, I was living in apartments and stuff, and I make her these tortillas, and she takes a bite and literally throws it at me. This is not quality, girlfriend. You know what I mean? She's I've taught you better. And I'm I'm dealing with an electric stove, abuelita, This isn't, there's not a gas stove here.
Araceli Esparza is a writer based in Madison and hosts the podcast Midwest Mujeres. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Tortilla, tortilla, necesitas una tortilla, tortilla.
The majority of hospitals in the U.S. are nonprofit, meaning they get tax breaks in exchange for giving free or low-cost care to people who couldn't otherwise afford it. Nonprofit hospitals get billions of dollars in federal tax breaks to provide this care. But a recent analysis by the Wall Street Journal finds that nonprofit hospitals provide significantly less charity care than their for-profit counterparts. Anna Wilde Matthews is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal covering healthcare. She's also originally from Wisconsin. Anna, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
You looked at the tax write-offs for charity care of nonprofit and for-profit hospitals. We gave away a little bit of it, but what did you find?
Well, we used filings that the hospitals make with the federal Medicare agency. And what we did is looked at the amount they were spending on so-called charity care or financial assistance for patients to help them pay for their care. And we looked at that compared to their revenue. So we could figure out sort of how much of their revenue was basically going toward helping their patients afford care. And we found overall the numbers were pretty low. The percentages were pretty low. For the nonprofits, it was about 2.3% overall in aggregate of patient revenue. For the for-profits, it was actually a bit higher, 3.4%. And then for government hospitals, it was actually the highest at 4.7% of revenue.
Is that difference in percentage significant?
Well, one might feel that all of them are a pretty limited slice of the total revenue. But yes, if you look at the difference between 2.3% and 3.4%, you know, that's a substantial difference.
Sure, when you're dealing with billions of dollars. You also looked at how much hospitals actually spent on the charity care, and you found again that nonprofit hospitals come up short against for-profit hospitals. What are those numbers?
Well, we looked at it just in a percentage form because obviously the dollar amounts will vary depending on the size of the hospital. But we did look at some sort of specific hospitals where you could see the numbers. One prominent one, for instance, was Stanford Healthcare, which we've all heard of out in California. They were spending 0.5%, 0.5% of patient revenue. That translates into $19.5 million of financial assistance, which seems like a lot, and it is, but their patient revenue was $4.18 billion, and its net income was $306 million, which was 15 times the amount that went out on charity care.
So we're talking with Anna Wilde Matthews, who's a reporter for the Wall Street Journal covering healthcare. And federal regulations give these nonprofit hospitals leeway to decide who gets the financial aid. So it's different from hospital to hospital. What did you find about how nonprofit hospitals set those requirements to get help?
What we found and what we heard from experts and advocates is that it really does vary quite a lot. And patients really have no idea when they go to a hospital what the standards are going to be. Hospitals typically do have income cutoffs, and they usually do that as a percentage of the federal poverty levels. So some hospitals may give 100% write-offs to people who are making 200% of the federal poverty level or 300%, but some may only give it to people making 100% of the federal poverty level. And then in addition to the income cutoffs, hospitals have all sorts of other things. Some want to look at your assets. So do you have things that you own, a house? Do you have maybe a retirement account? They'll look at that, and that will figure into whether they feel you should get financial assistance. They can also look at other non-financial things. So some, for instance, want to look at your immigration status and ask if you are a green card holder or a citizen. And if not, perhaps you won't be eligible. They also will look at your insurance status. Some will not give financial assistance to people who have insurance, even if they have limited insurance that leaves them with substantial out-of-pocket bills.
How does that affect patients?
Well, we found that some patients who really felt they couldn't afford bills yet were not eligible or could not obtain financial assistance. So it does seem to leave some patients who can't afford to pay what they're being billed without assistance to help. You can see in this country there is a substantial amount of medical debt. Obviously, that comes from all sources, not only nonprofit hospitals and not only hospitals, but the estimates out there from different types of research show that the amount of medical debt in collections estimates range from $88 billion to $140 billion. So clearly, there are a lot of people in the U.S. who are being hit with medical bills that they can't afford.
What are resources that people can use to see if they're eligible for that financial assistance or maybe get help with medical debt?
So nonprofit hospitals are required to have a financial assistance policy, and it is supposed to be on their website and easily available. So if you've gone to a nonprofit hospital, you should be able to find a financial assistance policy on their website. You should be able to call and get a copy. You should be able to read through it, and it should tell you how to apply and what's required. For other types of hospitals, typically they do have financial assistance policies. Sometimes you need to ask for them, and maybe they might not be on the website clearly available, but they typically do have them. There are ways to get help. The financial assistance process is not always easy or simple or intuitive. So there are advocates that folks can turn to for help. A lot of legal aid folks, they may be able to help, or at least if you get to the sort of a legal proceeding, they might be able to help. There's a nonprofit called Dollar Four that works with a lot of patients who are seeking financial assistance on their hospital or medical bills. And there are a lot of just sort of private advocates and other nonprofits out there if you look. Mm.
Excellent. Thank you so much for that information. And I know there's more in your reporting. Anna, we appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Anna Wilde Matthews is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal covering healthcare. She's talking to us about her analysis, finding that nonprofit hospitals spend less on patient financial assistance than their for-profit counterparts.